You know that old saying, when it rains, it pours? Yeah, that kind of sums up this past week across the valley. And when it pours, it often floods.
This is one reason why designing for floods is so hard. It's because we don't control rain, and you can have a very severe rain that can happen almost anywhere.
I'm Mark Brody, today on the show, trying to design for floods in urban and rural areas. Also, time's a-ticking for candidates to get out their message and get their supporters to vote Tuesday. How police shootings affect how residents and officers go about their business. And a picture is worth a thousand words, or in this case, a second top photo prize.
It was kind of in a ditch, kind of off the trail. It's kind of an interesting perspective that I've not really seen before.
When we unveiled the names, it was like, oh my gosh, there he is again.
Plus, ditching in a ditch, and are you ready for some arena football? That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. What you see outside right now, probably what we should expect for the rest of the day. Look for a high of 96 degrees. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows near 80. Sunny skies over the weekend as well. No mention, at least of yet, of rain, which is kind of a departure from this past week. Look for highs right around 99 or 100 each day. It's 87 degrees right now in Phoenix. And one traffic problem to tell you about, it is on the 101 westbound in the North Valley. An accident at 19th Avenue has the shoulder blocked. A new commission will make recommendations on ways to improve access to justice, including use of Arizona's legal system and getting legal representation. Arizona Supreme Court Chief Justice Scott Bales ordered the formation of the Commission on Access to Justice and named Court of Appeals Judge Lawrence Winthrop as its chairman. Other members include lower court judges, court officials, and legal aid providers. Bales set initial priorities that include helping people representing themselves in legal matters to get access and fair processing of family court and eviction cases. Another is encouraging law firms to provide free legal services or financial support for legal aid. Winthrop says he also hopes to encourage more business involvement. He says a business can suffer when an employee is burdened by dealing with a legal matter. Earlier this week, supermarkets across the state pulled almond and peanut butter off their shelves due to possible salmonella contamination. That's a good thing. But Jolie Weiss, an infectious disease expert at the state's Health Services Department, says consumers may not be in the clear just yet.
Peanut butter can last a while, so people need to be aware, look in their pantries, look in their refrigerator to see if they might have any of that product available. And people can then go and look at the FDA webpage. And if they do have that product, then it's recommended that they throw it away.
So far, there haven't been any reported cases of salmonella in Arizona. Weiss says symptoms can include diarrhea, fever, and body aches and can last a couple of days. If you like politics, then Tuesday will probably be an exciting day for you. If you don't, well, maybe it'll mean you get a couple days off from the TV commercials, mailers, and robocalls from candidates and outside groups. Tuesday is primary day in Arizona, and that means we're officially in the campaign's home stretch right now. Jim Small is the editor of the Arizona Capital Times.
This is really the last chance for campaigns to both contact voters and try to get their message out to them. Also, I think, and perhaps more importantly, is really drive people to the polls. And it's that last push to go out and make sure people, if they haven't mailed the early ballots, you know, today's the deadline to do that, or, you know, get people who haven't gotten an early ballot to show up at their polling place on Tuesday and ideally, I think, cast votes that are favorable to that candidate.
So do you think at this point message is more important or just getting people to actually cast a ballot is more important?
Probably a little bit of both. I think really you probably see everything kind of turn a little bit more towards getting people to cast a ballot. I think there's this kind of a feeling that by this point, a lot of people do get kind of sick of the messaging. I mean, if they've been watching TV at all, they've been inundated with commercials.
Or answering their phone.
Or answering their phone.
Going to their mailbox.
Absolutely. If you've got a landline right now in a competitive district, whether it's legislative or congressional, you know, you've certainly been bombarded with phone calls at this point.
Are there races for which you've seen data or talked to people that are still particularly close that maybe we don't know how they're going to go yet?
Yeah, there's a couple of legislative races, and both of them kind of feed into this idea of what exactly will the quote-unquote moderate wing of the Republican caucus look like in the state Senate for the next 2 years. The first race involves Senator Bob Worsley, the Republican who beat Russell Pierce 2 years ago.
In Mesa.
In Mesa, yeah. It's a Mesa district, Legislative District 25. He voted with the governor on a variety of things, on Common Core, on the Medicaid expansion. He's running against an orthopedic surgeon named Ralph Heap, who is running basically on an anti-Obamacare, anti-Medicaid expansion platform. It is one of the core parts of his message. And this race, by all accounts, is very close. Right north of that, you've got a Scottsdale-centric district, District 23, where you have Representative John Kavanaugh is attempting to move from the House to the Senate. He is being challenged by a man named Jeff Schwartz. This race, again, has attracted a lot of outside interest, a lot of outside money, a lot of very, you know, negative campaigning.
Are there any of the statewide races that are coming down to the wire?
Well, it looks like the governor's race, by all accounts, seems to be pretty solidified that Doug Ducey's going to be the nominee. I think it would shock a lot of people if he somehow, you know, woke up Wednesday morning and wasn't getting ready to run a race against Fred Duval in the general. But the other races, really, it's tough to know exactly what's going on. I mean, you've got this attorney general's race between, you know, a beleaguered Tom Horn and a newcomer that really hardly anybody knows who he is, in Mark Brnovich. The general thought has been that Tom Horn was going to be dead, you know, not be able to get past his primary. But started to be a lot of talk in the past few days that well, maybe Tom Horn does have the means to get past this election at least, and then we'll see how he fares in the general. That one, I don't think anyone really has a good, clear sense of. The Secretary of State's race, we've seen some polling on it, but it's just kind of been all over the place and hasn't been consistent, and we don't really know what we're looking at, whether it's going to be Michelle Reagan or Justin Pierce, who's had almost $1 million spent on his behalf by some of these anonymous outside groups, or is it going to be Will Cardin, who ran unsuccessfully for the U.S. Senate 2 years ago?
Do you get the sense that by the time we go to sleep Tuesday night, will there be any races that we don't know who the winner is yet?
There probably will be. Every year there seems to be one or two of those races. Sometimes they're surprises. There's almost certainly going to be something like that where at the very least you're going to have to wait until the first returns come back on Wednesday afternoon, the first supplemental returns, to find out exactly which way this race is trending.
Jim Small is the editor of the Arizona Capital Times. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's been a rainy week in the Valley. Most of it fell on Tuesday, but parts of the Valley also saw rain at other times, including this morning. But some of the areas that experienced flooding were outside the metro area, where there's less infrastructure to deal with it. Ben Ruddle is an engineering professor at ASU, specializing in water resources and hydrology.
The hardest part is that in rural areas, we don't have a lot of good data on how much it rains, and we haven't been there many times when it's flooding. So the scientific professionals, like those at the USGS Arizona Water Science Center, who collect that flood data, may not have been to a particular creek or wash to actually look at it and take measurements when there was a flood happening before. So the absence of good scientific data to use as a baseline for those flood designs is the biggest challenge.
When you're looking at data in an urban area, obviously there are agencies that have monitors and gauges, but they're not everywhere. Do you still face a similar challenge about good data in urban areas?
Not as big of a challenge. Of course, we always need more data and better. Also, there's a key difference between the rural area outside of the city and the city itself. Inside the city, most of the hydrology, that is, most of the rainfall and runoff processes and flooding processes, have been designed by people. We put down concrete, we use bulldozers, we shape the earth, and a lot of what you see around you in the city has been specifically designed to shed water and retain it and prevent flooding of key infrastructure.
So does that mean in rural areas most of it is not man-made, it's just sort of what nature put there?
That's right. In rural areas, it's very natural, and there wasn't an engineer who decided how big that wash was going to be or where to put it or whether there was a retention basin.
It seems like if you have a house in a rural area and your house is next to a creek or next to a wash or in an area that is low-lying or something and you get a lot of rain, it seems logical as an outsider that you should be concerned about flooding. Is there more to it than that?
There's a little more to it, but I think your common sense explanation is pretty much right on. About a third of a given desert area is going to be some type of floodplain or wash. These places are dry most of the time in Arizona, but you can tell where they are because you can see that water has flowed there in the past, and you can tell that they are lower than the surrounding areas. So basically, any place that's a low spot that's outside the city is going to be subject to flooding.
Is the answer, do you think, to get better information to people by having better data or by having engineers go and actually design in rural areas some of the infrastructure that we have in the urban areas?
Well, we will never be able to afford to design levees and dams and flood control for every place in the world. Also, that's not really desirable because it's important to understand that our washes and riparian areas, those are the keys to all the desert habitat and wildlife. And if engineers go in there and start putting in concrete and dams and levees and altering that place, we do a lot of environmental damage. So the idea is actually to tread lightly and do as little as possible in those floodplains out in the desert.
So in that sense, if you live sort of outside of a metro area, is it just sort of part of life that, hey, my area might flood and I have to deal with that?
So it is a part of life, but you can change your odds. In this country, we have a national flood insurance program, and we have floodplain mapping. These are actually being re-engineered right now and redelineated. Those floodplains are being redelineated by FEMA, and they're redelineating the entire country's floodplains using modern advanced technology. Also, they're taking into account how those washes may have changed. So this redelineation is going to give us a more accurate idea of where floods can happen.
Earlier this week, with all the rain we had on Tuesday, there was a lot of flooding along I-17, both in the area of Greenway and then further north in the area of Dixieleta, Happy Valley. What is it about that I-17 corridor that led to all that flooding? And maybe is there something that needs to be done differently over there?
Well, there's a couple factors at work up there. One is that you had an unusually severe, we'll see, the record books are not clear yet. They're going to revise the numbers, but that may have been the record rainfall in that area. So that's one major factor. That area was simply unlucky, and they got a very severe concentrated rainfall. So that can happen anywhere. It can happen anytime, any place. And this is one reason why designing for floods is so hard. It's because we don't control rain, and you can have a very severe rain that can happen almost anywhere.
Ben Ruddle is an engineering professor at ASU specializing in water resources and hydrology. Still to come, after police shootings, residents tend to get armed, which can pose problems for those communities.
The mixture of anger and feelings and tension, and then you complicate that with weapons, the outcome is probably not going to be a positive one.
That's ahead. It's the show. Not too much going on traffic-wise right now around the valley. Just one problem spot on the 101 westbound at 19th Avenue. An accident there has the shoulder blocked. We're looking for a high temperature today of 96 degrees. It should stay fairly sunny for the rest of the afternoon. Look for clear skies tonight, overnight lows near 80, and a dry and sunny weekend for you with a high of 99 tomorrow, 102 on Sunday. It's 90 degrees right now at 216.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Theater Company, the State Theater. Season tickets available featuring a Tony Award-winning comedy, a world premiere by an Emmy Award-winning writer, and a zany musical. More information at arizonatheater.org.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Mark Brody. Health officials say that of the people infected with Ebola in West Africa, three-quarters are women. The Minister of Information in Liberia says that's largely because the patriarchal structure of West African society puts women in the most direct path as carriers and makes them most vulnerable to infection. Women are overwhelmingly the caregivers, food preparers, nurses, and housekeepers responsible for cleaning and water collection.
To explore this more, we turn to Gina Moore, global women's rights reporter for BuzzFeed. She just returned from Liberia a few days ago. So how does the structure of society in places like Liberia really put women right on the front lines?
You know, it's actually not all that different when you get down to it from the structure of society at home back in the States. women are on the front lines of caregiving. And I think many of us have seen that in our own houses too. It's formal and it's informal. They're most of the nursing staff in the hospitals and the clinics. They're the people who inside the home are cleaning everything, taking care, making sure sick people get their medicine or whatever the treatment may be. The case with Ebola, though, is that there's no cure, there's no vaccine, there's no real treatment except keeping someone as hydrated as possible and waiting to see. And in the meantime, as people get sick, they need to be cared for, they need to be cleaned, they need to be attended to. And all that tends to fall on the shoulders of women.
And because the transmission agent of Ebola is bodily fluids or direct contact with the bodies of infected individuals, that's the means by which Ebola is transmitted from patients to women, nurses, and caregivers.
Yeah, that's right. It's actually fairly difficult to catch Ebola if you're not in a caregiving situation or you're not one of the family members who's attending to the burial rites, because it does require direct contact. It passes through bodily fluids. And those who are caring for people or those who in the past have been burying people as one traditionally might in a normal funeral ceremony have been highest at risk. The disease also gets more and more contagious as it progresses. So as someone is sick, as someone approaches death, the risk to the caregivers gets higher.
How does this disrupt the structure of society in Liberia? Does it mean women are absent from the homes if they're if they're fatalities, and that puts families and other dependents at risk?
Well, if you imagine the inside of a house, and imagine a family in Liberia as bigger than your average American family. Family in Liberia includes not just the immediate family, father, mother, kids, but also cousins, maybe a grandmother, maybe some aunties. And if one person in that house gets sick, everyone in that house is at risk, because by the time a person is symptomatic, he or she is very contagious. And it's likely going to be all of the women in that house, the wife, the sisters, the aunties, the daughters, who are taking care of the sick person. And they, if they're doing this without protective equipment, which most of them are in Liberian homes, they're at risk for getting sick as well. So you can begin to imagine the ripple effect that this will have just in a family, in one house, to say nothing of house to house to house to house in a small community. But there's also something else I think is really important in terms of how this disrupts society. The only way to protect yourself from getting Ebola when you're encountering a sick patient is not to touch them. And in Liberia, just like at home, the language of love and compassion for the people who are sick is human touch. And it's really, really difficult to look at someone you love and not be able to touch them in a time of need. And that's a real spiritual disruption.
And it's something universal that I think everyone can imagine. Is education and the distribution of countermeasures, you know, sterilization equipment, protection for hands and masks and the like a solution here?
Certainly. There is protective equipment that can be distributed to healthcare workers, and we need a lot more of that to move a lot more quickly. Latex gloves are a huge need in Liberia right now for doctors and nurses who are on the front lines of care. But no one is planning to issue latex gloves to all of the mothers of Liberia. And so there will always be some private risk inside the home until the disease is under control and eventually dies down. But all the indications are that that's going to take quite a long time.
If women are the caregivers and also the predominant majority of those infected, who's caring for the women?
It's a good question. It's other women, I think, although you can also find really, really tragic stories where the answer is no one. I met a 61-year-old man in West Point, which is an informal neighborhood in Liberia that was in the news last week because the community had been uncomfortable with the clinic there and had attacked it, closed this Ebola holding center, and now the community is under quarantine to control the spread of the disease. It's densely packed so the disease can move quickly. The 61-year-old man I met there before the quarantine was put into place told me that his brother had died of Ebola and that he had passed it to his wife. They had three children, but the children were saved because they are living with another relative somewhere else in the country. And I asked him how the wife had gotten Ebola. And he said, well, she took care of my brother. And then I asked him who took care of her. And he said, no one. Everyone was too afraid.
Finally, Gina, NGOs suspect that it will take 6 months or more to get Ebola under control in these areas. Do you see a permanent disruption to the structure of society in the places you visited?
Certainly, that's a sort of terrifying window to a lot of the people who are working on the response. That's a really long time, and there's so much need right now for equipment and help. But it's important to remember that even though this is a fairly contagious disease, it's also very rare. There are 4 million people living in Liberia, and there are about 1,200 cases that have been reported as of the newest numbers from the World Health Organization. So it's certainly risky. It can spread very quickly. But right now, we're still thankfully talking about a small portion of the population. I think the bigger effects are going to be from the fear and suspicion and distrust this creates between neighbors and friends, and that sort of spiritual rift we were talking about when you can't care for the loved ones who are dying.
Gina Moore is global human rights reporter for BuzzFeed. She just returned from Liberia, spoke with us from London. Thanks so much, Gina.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. The unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, following the shooting death of unarmed African-American teenager Michael Brown, is sparking many discussions. One of them is about the kind of equipment law enforcement agencies have and use. Jeff Hines spent more than 30 years with the Phoenix Police Department. He now teaches at ASU and Glendale Community College and says it's common for people to stock up on weapons and ammunition following a high-profile incident like this one.
For anybody that lives or works in an area where violence like that is occurring or where there is mass social unrest as far as these protests and the issue of looting and the issue of fires and burning cars and Molotov cocktails, is that it's just a natural reaction to defend yourself and to want to arm yourself. And those two ingredients, hostility, racial tension, and then you instill weapons for protection into that mix, absolutely a blend for the potential for increased violence to continue. And so do people arm themselves? Absolutely they do. Do they have a right to arm themselves? Absolutely they do. But the mixture of anger and feelings and tension, and then you complicate that with weapons, the outcome is probably not going to be a positive one.
If I'm a law enforcement officer going into a situation where I think, rightly or wrongly, that more people might be armed or equipped than normal, how does that change how I'm going to do my job?
It makes your awareness at a very heightened stage. And so we go into what's called a contact and cover scenario, is that I've got to contact you, reference the call. I've got to contact you, reference the focus of my attention, or I've got to contact you, reference a call for service. Well, as I go up to make that contact with somebody, if you're armed, absolutely, I'm going to inform you that I see that you have a weapon. I'm going to ask you to turn around. I'm going to ask you to allow me to secure that weapon while we continue with this call. I'm going to ask you to be cooperative with me. We still have to engage. We still have to talk to people who are armed. And I'm here to tell you, 99% of people who are armed are law-abiding, decent citizens that are exercising their right to carry weapons, and law enforcement has to honor that. But with respect, with de-escalation, with informing the public that the fact that you have a weapon on you, sir, is going to amp me up a little bit, so please do everything I'm telling you to do right now, and let's get through the reason for this contact. And then when we're done, I will return your weapon to you, and you're free to go.
There's been a decent amount of talk since the shooting in Ferguson about this issue of cameras and whether police wear them, have them on their dashboard, or anything like that.
Yes.
Does an incident like this sort of raise the stakes for whether or not departments have this equipment and whether or not departments are currently utilizing this equipment?
Interesting question. It comes down to right now an issue of cost. And the cost is associated with the storage of the mega data files is created by these videos. And most agencies have not worked out that storage capacity yet or those cost issues. Most officers in most departments, we look forward to videos. And in my 32 years with Phoenix PD, anybody who says, well, I have a tape recording or a video, I would embrace it. Say, well, great, thank you.
On the other side of the cost equation, we've seen that shares in Taser stock, obviously an Arizona company, have been going up recently. Taser makes some of these body-worn cameras that law enforcement officers make. Taser, of course, also makes stun guns, which a lot of law enforcement agencies have started to deploy. It sounds probably kind of crass, but is it accurate to say that a company like Taser might actually financially benefit from an incident like what happened in Ferguson?
Anytime you have increased media attention on a specific incident and you start looking at less lethal tools in the form of a Taser or less lethal tools in the form of a stun bag or something that is anything less than the use of the firearm is going to be embraced by the public. And anytime you have a shooting situation, the public is going to say, could you have done something less rather than to have shot this young man?
Jeff Hines spent more than 30 years with the Phoenix Police Department. He now teaches at Glendale Community College and at ASU.
In Arizona, seventh wonderland.
The Grand Canyon of the Colorado, a titanic gash across the state of Arizona, never ceases to be an overwhelming spectacle.
On Monday, the National Park Service turns 98 years old, almost as old as Arizona. In celebration of its birthday, it's offering you a present. You can get in free at select parks all over the country. 16 of those parks are right here in Arizona, and they draw huge crowds every year. In fact, Arizona is home to the second most visited national park in the country. You can probably guess which one it is.
John Burroughs, poet and naturalist, called it the Divine Abyss.
The Grand Canyon alone generates 5 million visitors a year, but all of the 22 parks and monuments in the state actually generate over 10 million people. So you're talking about an economic impact of about $774 million.
That's Sherry Henry, Director of Tourism for Arizona. She says even though many of our schools have resumed classes, neighboring states are still on summer vacation and their residents are enjoying road trips through Arizona. She says the free admission to many of the national parks offers a perfect opportunity for people to visit.
It's like getting people through the doors. You have a new generation of people and they really want to introduce all levels of people, particularly the younger people, into the experience of a national park.
You can find a full list of parks that are offering free admission at kjzz.org. It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Campbell McGee, and today we're doing a bronze pour at Bollinger Atelier. We're doing the lost wax process, so that means we make an exact replica of the sculpture in wax, and then dip it usually up to 25 coats of this shell. It's like silica sand and slurry. We take that out, drill holes in it, melt out all of that wax, have a perfect negative shell, and then preheat those shells to pour the metal into. They have to be preheated at 1600 degrees. It takes about 2 hours to preheat those. We melt down the metal and then pour it all from there out of a hoist.
That's Campbell McGee pouring a bronze sculpture at Bollinger Atelier in Tempe. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want us to go ahead and step in concrete, send us a note at the show at kjzz.org. Just ahead, want to meet some really friendly people?
Quilters are the nicest people, and so it's very rare to meet a crabby quilter. They're out there, but, you know, it's very rare.
An introduction to the community of quilters is still to come. It's the show. Should be a pretty nice weekend for the Phoenix area. Look for clear skies tonight, overnight lows near 80. Sunny skies both tomorrow and Sunday with a high of 99. Tomorrow, 102 on Sunday. It's 90 degrees right now. In Valley traffic, just one problem spot still. It's on the 101 westbound at 19th Avenue. An accident there has the shoulder blocked.
KJZZ is supported by Area Agency on Aging, celebrating 40 years of delivering home and community-based services, supporting family caregivers and protecting elders. Donation and volunteer information at aaaphx.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Police in Missouri say the unarmed black teenager shot by police last weekend was suspected of taking part in a robbery at a convenience store just minutes before the shooting, but that the officer who fired at Michael Brown did not know that at the time. Brown's family is angry that police have released a video purporting to show Brown in the store at the time of the robbery. Anthony Gray is a family spokesman.
The family feels that that was strategic. They think it was aimed at denigrating their son. It was a character assassination attempt.
Missouri Governor Jay Nixon says he understands the frustration of the family and others in the community over the naming of Brown as a robbery suspect.
There's a lot of steps between now and when justice is served. And there are going to be a lot of other bounces along the way. And there'll be a lot of tension at various times.
But Nixon is urging people in the community to remain calm. The European Union is offering to take over security at the border crossings into and out of the Gaza Strip and to work to help to prevent illegal shipments of weapons there. EU foreign ministers approved the offer at a meeting in Brussels today. Negotiators for Israel and the Palestinians are still meeting in Egypt, trying to work out a sustainable truce for Gaza. Authorities in New York State say two Amish girls who are now safely back at home were kidnapped from their family farm stand on Wednesday. Sheriff Kevin Wells says police believe more than one person was responsible.
We're making every effort and not cutting any corners whatsoever to find the perpetrators and to make the arrests.
Wells says the girls are in good health and are cooperating with investigators. A gauge of the prices businesses receive when they sell goods and services has edged up a bit, rising a seasonally adjusted 0.1% last month. Producer prices were up 0.2%, excluding the volatile food and energy categories. Wall Street Today stocks were mixed. The Dow was down 50 points. The Nasdaq was up 11. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Emma, email marketing for the modern brand, featuring mobile templates, social tools, and concierge services. More at myemma.com. This is KJZZ.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and even international news. For the past 6 years, Arizona Highways magazine has put on a photo contest. This year's winner, 23-year-old Chiku Baiju of Chandler, is actually pretty familiar with the contest. He also won it in 2009-2010. He and the magazine's photo editor, Jeff Kidda, joined me this week. Chiku says before he took the winning photo, it had been a while since he'd shot any.
We went to Los Dutchman State Park to go shoot sunset. It was during springtime, so there wasn't a whole lot of flowers at that time. Sunset was kind of a dud, so he kind of said, well, we should probably stick around, do some nice shots. I'm like, oh, I've never tried nice shots with flowers in them. So we just kind of hung around, gave it a try, found a pretty neat composition. It was kind of in a ditch, kind of off the trail. It looked like it was kind of an interesting perspective that I've not really seen before.
And Jeff, what struck you about this photo? What led it to win?
Well, it's just that. It's the fact that it's a nighttime exposure. I mean, we see a lot of things from, I certainly see a lot of things from the Superstition Mountains. And a lot of those things are done during monsoons or springtime. But I don't see a lot of night photos. And then what Chiku did is he combined night photography with the sparseness of flowers. But then there's this, these stars, these little flecks of stars in the sky. And they sort of balance the wildflowers in the foreground. And his composition is very nice, as a matter of fact. There is a balance there because it's a Cholla cactus sort of center right in the photograph. And it is part of the image, it's part of the superstitions, but it doesn't impede your view.
Was it a difficult decision? I mean, I would imagine you got probably a lot of really nice pictures.
We did, and we actually, I do a rough edit. I do an edit for the contest much like I would the monthly magazine at Arizona Highways. And what I will do is a rough edit. I'll take 5,000 images and trim them down into three categories. And I'll sit with the art director and we'll get them down to the top 30 for each category. And then as a staff, we sit down and we mull things over and we go through them. And and everybody's got their shots, and we don't look at names. We never look at names. And Chico won the second time.
And what was your reaction when you found out that it was Chico who had won and that this was a name that you were familiar with?
Well, the thing of it is I've seen his work now over not a lot, but I do check into his website every now and then. And I wasn't all that surprised because for somebody, and excuse me, Chico, you're young, but for somebody of his age, he has a very mature eye. He sees things very well, whereas somebody his age, what I see a lot of is people copying the style of others. And he really has his own vision already.
Chico, tell me a little bit about how you got into photography, because as Jeff said, you are fairly young. You're 23. You've won this contest now twice. What's your photographic background?
It all started for me in high school. It was my junior year. I had my last elective to take, and photography was the only elective left. So I ended up taking it. Started off with film. I really enjoyed the whole darkroom process. Then we got into digital photography, and that one kind of opened up a whole variety of possibilities. So from that point on, I was just hooked. And then after that, bought my own camera after I got my first job, and then just started driving everywhere, taking new pictures, trying new different styles, different types of techniques and stuff like that.
Now, am I right that photography is not a career for you, at least at this point, right? You have a quote-unquote day job, right?
Right, right.
So what is it about photography that makes it an appealing hobby or aspiration for you?
It's just something that I enjoy doing a lot. I mean, it's not just a hobby. It's also, something I eventually want to pursue as a full-time thing. But I just want to finish up school, get a degree in. That way I have something to fall back on.
And you've done that now, right?
Yes.
Jeff, was there any discussion either inside Arizona Highways or outside that like the fix was in or something like this? I mean, that it was maybe more than a coincidence that one person had won it twice?
No, we laughed. It was, it was one of those things where we all just, when we unveiled the names, it was like, oh my gosh, there he is again. But no, it wasn't one of those, it did give us a little bit pause. It's like, something, is somebody going to say something? But the truth of the matter is even when I edit work for the monthly magazine, if we do a general stock call, say for spring flowers or fall leaves, I do not look at names when I look at him. I'm looking at images purely and simply. I keep names out of it.
Any chance you can give this guy some work?
There is a good chance I can give this guy some work. He just has to send it to me.
You mentioned that at some point you'd like to pursue photography. Do you have a sense of how you'd like to do that, what you'd like to do?
Not sure yet, but I know I eventually want to get into it. I mean, I want to get back into the field first. It's been a while. It's been a hectic year, finishing up school, getting into work. So slowly getting back into it, and then eventually probably to do some work for Arizona Highways would be really nice.
Chico Baiju, the two-time winner of Arizona Highways Magazine's photo contest. I was also joined by the magazine's photo editor, Jeff Kidda, and we'll post the winning photo at kjzz.org. KJZZ is exploring what it means to be part of a community in a series called We Are the Valley. This week, we'll take a look at a community of people with the same hobby, quilters. And we thought, who better to send than our very own Carrie Young? Carrie and her family are in the business of quilting, so she knows the ins and outs, like what it means to stitch a ditch.
Have you seen the one where they do the tape measure, the old tape measures?
Yes.
In the Three Dudes Quilt Shop in Ahwatukee, a group of about 15 quilters, all women, have gathered for their weekly open sew. Dude Raymond Steves starts the morning off with a warm welcome.
Welcome, everybody. Okay.
All right.
Everyone's working on their own project today. Some women are cutting fabric, others are planning out their quilt structures, and some, like Sherry Majewski, are actually doing some sewing.
Put the needle down.
I'm working on a triangles on a roll quilt, and it's going to be in light and dark greens.
These women are here today because they all love to quilt. But it's more than that. What keeps Majewski and others like Nedra Sorensen coming back each week is the people.
You just make the best friends at these kinds of things. Quilters are the nicest people. And so it's very rare to meet a crabby quilter. You just make girlfriends fast.
Which is something Michael Ann Stevens says she doesn't take for granted. Stevens joined the group a few months ago after moving to the Valley from Washington State.
And I came in and they heard, you know, that I was brand new to the area. And Nedra says, oh, girlfriend, you just need to hang out with us. And I just like, okay, I found my peeps.
Stevens is a self-described quilting newbie. But she says so far, everyone has been supportive in showing her the ropes, both in navigating the city and on her sewing machine.
They're really kind about how they tell me, maybe you try it this way.
She says the way you know you've really got it down is when you can speak the language.
Fat quarter is not a fat half or a fat square.
Right.
As a quilting industry veteran, well, let me translate. A fat quarter is basically a quarter of a yard piece of fabric. But it doesn't stop there. If you hang around quilters long enough, chances are you'll also hear terms like fussy cutting, stitching in the ditch, and appliqué. But it's more than just fun. The connections here really do run deep. These women tell each other about their families and what's going on in their lives. They're here for each other.
I call it my therapy. I tell my husband I could spend thousands of dollars on psychiatric bills, or you could send me to three dudes. He says, I'll send you to three dudes. Yeah, just keep quilting.
Just keep quilting. Direction Sorensen and the handful of other women here today say they'll gladly heed. For the We Are the Valley Community Series, I'm Carrie Young.
And if you're part of a community that you want to tell us about, write us. wearethevalley@kjzz.org. It's time to head out to another hot corner, a part of the valley with a lot going on. As always, let's meet our tour guide.
I am Gwen Ashley Walters, and I'm a food writer for Phoenix Magazine.
And we are underneath a hard-working bank of misters here on the patio. Where are we?
We are in Phoenix, and this is the patio of the Flower Child from Sam Fox Restaurant.
It's one of a handful of relatively new restaurants at 44th Street and Camelback.
About four restaurants have opened here in the last year, less than a year maybe.
So we're outside here at Flower Child.
Flower Child.
This is one of two Sam Fox restaurants. If you don't know Sam Fox, he's behind
15 concepts.
Yeah, there's a lot.
In
if
you've
eaten at a restaurant in the Valley, there's a decent chance you've eaten at one of Fox's restaurants.
Right.
So there's Flower Child and then the Henry, just sort of kitty corner to here.
Right.
What kind of restaurants are these, first of all?
These are Sam Fox restaurants. They have two different personalities, which is typical of Sam Fox restaurants here. But we are on the corner of 44th and Camelback, and the Henry across the street is billed as the greatest neighborhood restaurant.
Setting the bar pretty high on that, are we?
Well, that is Sam Fox's, his own moniker for that place. But it's an American brasserie, and it is really cool. It is breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and right above that is his own headquarters.
And then Flower Child here, kind of a hip, healthy kind of place?
Yeah, it is. It's beautiful, actually. It's counter-served.
So across 44th Street from where we are, a place called The Chestnut, relatively new, right?
Right. And I think it is the first one that probably started this whole hot corner here. And it is breakfast and lunch, and it's a great little place. They actually have a little florist inside. That's kind of unusual to have a restaurant and have a little florist inside. But they are the one that I think that revolutionized this corner here.
And what's the fourth? You mentioned there are four relatively new places. What's the fourth?
Steak 44. Just up from Flower Child here, and it's the Michael Dominick's people, the Mastro family. They have a great steakhouse up there. It took over the Cork and Cleaver spot.
Now, this is not a neighborhood that, before these four, was totally devoid of places to eat. I mean, there's a lot of places to eat in this neighborhood. What do these four sort of add to the neighborhood that maybe weren't here before?
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is that they all are like lunch or breakfast and they're just kind of revitalizing this whole area here. There wasn't a whole lot of breakfast or lunch places here that are casual that you can stop in. And it's the whole price point thing again and what they're offering. And I think it's really different.
When new restaurants come to a neighborhood, does that help the places that were already here? I mean, is there kind of a trickle-down effect of maybe people going to Flower Child and seeing a place like Taylor's, for example, which is in the same shopping center, or maybe travel a little bit down the road and see some of the places in the Biltmore Fashion Park?
Right. I think so. And I think that this is the first time that we've had four restaurants. Well, let's just say three, because Steak 44 is only open at night, but three restaurants that offer lunch. So right here on this little corner are four brand new restaurants at the right price point to bring in, you know, both the business people and probably the people that are just moms shopping. There's an AJ's right behind us.
Well, and speaking of business people, I mean, there's a lot of offices around here. There's a ton of people who work here who probably need a place to go during lunch at least a couple days a week, right?
Right, right. So this now brings a lot more to them before, because their choices before were maybe, I think there's a Mexican restaurant next door called Garcia's, and then they'd have to drive a little further. But right here on this, it is literally a crossroad.
As a restaurateur, is it different to be targeting people who are coming for lunch for work, who maybe need to, don't have all the time in the world, versus people who maybe live in the neighborhood? Because there are a lot of residences around here. A lot of people live sort of within a mile or two of this place. Is it the same kind of marketing, the same kind of food, the same kind of price point when you're targeting what seems like two different groups of people?
I think so at this point in this time, it seems like to me, because, well, if you look at the menus from these three places that are here open for lunch, they're going to appeal to everyone. That is one of the things that I think Sam Fox is really good at. He's like, he figures out how to create a menu that is very diverse, and lots of people, from business people to moms to older people, are all going to be attracted to.
Gwen Ashley Walters is a food writer for Phoenix Magazine. We met at the corner of 44th Street and Camelback in Phoenix. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Pretty light Friday traffic so far. Look for a sunny weekend on the way as well, with a high of 99 tomorrow, 102 on Sunday.
KJZZ is supported by SRP. With a 24/7 workforce and reliable grid, if there's an outage, power can usually be restored within 2 hours. You can sign up for outage alerts at srpgrid.com. SRP, delivering more than power.
The drought in California is being felt across the state, but especially in agriculture and winemaking. The BBC's Justin Rolat visited Nathan Cardella at his family's winery.
So basically, we produce various amounts of red wines, white wines here.
And what scale is it now? How much wine are you making here?
I'm producing about 5,000 cases annually, roughly about 120 tons worth of fruit. And we really need to teach people that what we are doing with the water is a good thing. We're feeding you, you know, we're producing food for people to consume.
We've just paused this. I'm guessing it's one of your water pumps,
is it? This is one of our water wells, yeah. So it's getting water out of the ground from about 800 feet. The well's 1,200 feet. And I've been out here for 20 years. And for the last 2 or 3 years, the wells have basically been running nonstop. And prior to that, I never saw the wells running.
Wow. So that is a dramatic change. And how much water do you pump out with this?
This right now, we can go check the meter, but it should be pumping about 800 gallons per minute. We're at about 700 right now, so it's gone down a little bit. And that's as a result of the water table dropping.
There's simply less water down there.
Simply less water down there.
So could we go down and see the actual winemaking operation?
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. So we're going down into our cellar right now. We're going to be going about 14 feet below ground. It's nice and cool down here.
Oh, it's lovely and cool, yeah. Can we try some of the wine?
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. So I figured we could start off with a nice chilled Pinot Grigio. So Pinot Grigio is an Italian variety. And chin chin.
Chin chin.
And we enjoy it. And it's just a nice, refreshing wine.
Mm. Yeah, it's got some kind of berry-ish flavors. A bit of a kind of pinch on water isn't necessarily a problem for vineyards, for wineries, because you get a more flavor from your grapes. But there comes a point where presumably you are in trouble.
Well, it's not a problem this year, but it could be a problem next year. If you continually stress the vine, eventually the vine's going to give up and it's going to catch a disease and die.
So are you anxious about the long term? I mean, you're relatively new to this business. You've been doing it for, what, 10 years?
Yeah. Well, of course you are. You know, I mean, it's expensive to start up your own business. If things continue down the path that they're going, then it could all be for nothing. And so, yeah, there's a lot of stress. There's a lot of worry. There's a lot of people helping us out and a lot of people depending on us to stay in business. So there's a lot at stake.
So we come out of the cellar. In fact, we're standing next to a kind of worryingly large pond, which is built directly on top of the fabulous wine cellar below. And Peter, you're here as well. Tell us who you are and where you're from.
I'm Peter Vallis. I'm the executive director of the San Joaquin Valley Wine Growers Association and fourth generation California farmer.
Peter, talking about the wine and the wine industry generally, How big an industry is Californian wine now?
Well, wine and grapes are easily the second largest agricultural commodity in California, right behind dairy. What we get the international press for is definitely wine.
And so how much of an issue at the moment is the drought for the wine industry?
Well, it's going to affect several things. One, we are in a situation where we have to plant every year to keep up with our demand. Well, with uncertainty of water, we can't necessarily make those decisions to invest the $10,000 or so an acre to plant. Lack of water will reduce yields. And so that's going to create a gap in the supply side of wine in America. And it's going to change how we can export, it's going to change how we import, how we blend wines, and ultimately how we get wines to the consumer and the price points of those.
So how worried are you about the future of California wine?
Well, that's an interesting thing. Our colleagues in Napa Sonoma are direly worried that global warming is going to kick them out of the market. It's going to be too hot. They don't have any irrigation infrastructure. Whereas in some ways, what seems to be happening here in the Central Valley seems to be very good for our grape production. It seems to be improving our wine quality. However, on the flip side of that, there's more and more and more import pressure from Europe as the consumers in wine-drinking countries continue to drink less liters per person.
And if you begin to tanker in kind of grapes from elsewhere in the world, you know, is it really realistic to talk about California wine anymore?
Well, you know, California is a very strong brand. You know, people think California, it's a positive image. And what several producers have been doing to counterman the rising cost of grapes in California is to take their long-established California brand and substitute in Argentina and make the appellation far less visible or obvious on a label. And so if you go to the store, you will grab that brand, and the first bottle may say California, the second bottle Argentina, the third bottle Chile, fourth bottle Italy, California, and mix and match to further disconnect the consumer of the importance of the place their wine is coming from.
That's the BBC's Justin Rolat in California. It's kind of a weird time sports-wise. Baseball pennant races are starting to heat up, although the D-backs are clearly not involved. The NFL preseason is underway, but it'll still be a few weeks until the games actually mean something. But here in the Valley, this is a big sporting weekend. For one, the Arizona Rattlers of the Arena Football League will try to repeat this from last year.
That will do it. Arizona, back-to-back Arena Bowl champions.
Tomorrow night in Cleveland, the Rattlers will try to three-peat when they take on the hometown Gladiators. The Rattlers finished their season 17-3. They've beaten Philadelphia in the last two Arena Bowls and are looking for their fifth Arena Bowl championship overall. And then there's hoops.
And Phoenix indeed sets a new WNBA single season record, picking up its 29th win. And they head into the postseason as the top seed in the Western Conference, home court advantage throughout.
The Mercury hosts the LA Sparks tonight in Game 1 of their WNBA playoff series. They play Game 2 in Los Angeles on Sunday. The Mercury finished the regular season 29-5. They also had a 16-game winning streak from mid-June until the end of July. It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. Next week, we'll bring back our resident quiz master and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this puzzle. When can you add 2 to 11 and get 1 as the correct answer? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. Quick check of Valley traffic. An accident on the 101 westbound in the North Valley at 19th Avenue has the shoulder blocked. We've come to know it as the symbol of a long-lasting Arizona rivalry, but a recent investigation found the history behind it never had anything to do with two universities competing. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez has the story.
The Territorial Cup is the sought-after trophy between ASU and U of A. The Arizona Territorial Normal School, now ASU, first won it in 1899. Its history was that the Normals, as they were known, beat U of A in a championship game. Well, did you know that information is not true?
We did not win the cup as a direct result of the first ever meeting between ASU and U of A on Thanksgiving Day in 1899.
That's ASU archivist Robert Spindler. He's been combing through historical records, and what he found debunks several of the stories behind the trophy.
In fact, that did not cinch the cup for us. We had to play a few more games in order to have a clear winner.
Spindler discovered the Normals played a total of 7 games in the 1899-1900 season. It was the first season of the newly organized Arizona Football League. The organization consisted of Phoenix High School, Phoenix Indian School, and Arizona Territorial Normal School. U of A was added a short time later. Spindler also discovered that in the U of A midseason matchup, the Normals were not undefeated, but had a record of 2-1.
The game against the University of Arizona was the first ever meeting between these great rivals, and we did win 11-2, and it was an important game for us and for the University of Arizona.
The Normals clinched the championship on January 20th, 1900, against Indian School. Spindler's research found that there was an award ceremony 6 days later, where the cup was presented. The silver-plated trophy is about 8 inches tall, shaped like a flower with petals bent upward, with 3 handles and 3 feet welded to the body.
Now we recognize it as the symbol of this great rivalry between Arizona State University and the University of Arizona. And that's largely based on what I believe today was essentially the legend surrounding that first 1899 season.
The cup disappeared at some point after it was awarded and recovered from a Tempe church in 1983. Because Normal, or ASU, was the winner of the championship series, ASU owns it. In 2001, ASU agreed to share it with U of A, and each year, whoever wins the big game gets to showcase the cup. The trophy is so old, the silver is thinning. A replica was made to be used for special events. A second was created for the Tempe History Museum. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique or know things that we ought to know, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org. If you're looking for something to do this weekend, you might want to check out Tom Cotter tonight at Stand Up Live in downtown Phoenix. He was the runner-up in 2012 on America's Got Talent. He's been elsewhere since then. You can also see Colin Kane tonight through Sunday at the Tempe Improv, best known for the Howard Stern Show, as well as Opie and Anthony. Tony Bennett will be performing at the Mesa Arts Center tomorrow night, best known, of course, for popular standard, show tune, and jazz. Most recently, though, he sang duets with Lady Gaga. Also this weekend, Phantasm CopperCon 34 at the Hilton Garden Inn in Avondale, an event celebrating science fiction, media, literature, and film. The show was produced this week by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nick Blumberg, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Kendra Sabo, and Caitlin Stein. Tracy Greer and Maria Springs are our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening. It's 3 o'clock.